No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. And I'm joined by my co-host, Maria Sanchez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So you can call in with a question if you like and be part of the conversation at 888-627-6008. I don't know how many questions we'll take tonight because we have a very, very special guest. Maria, how are you? You doing okay?
Well out there in and California? Healthy. Yep. Thank Good. You so much, Michael, and your family as well.
Well, yeah, just we're all doing fine. Tonight we have Marianne Williamson, who was a Democratic presidential candidate. She's returning to the show. Marianne is a best-selling author, political activist, a spiritual thought leader. She's written 14 books. Many of them have become bestsellers. She has a really, really strong following. And we'd be remiss if we didn't mention that she started a project called Project Angel Food, which has fed over 13 million, given out 13 million meals to ill and dying homebound patients since 1989 when she started. God bless you, Ms. Williamson, for all you do for those around you. And thanks for being on our show again.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Let's start with the 800-pound gorilla in the room. We just had an election where 80 million people voted for Joe Biden, and that's good news for Democrats, but 74 million people voted for Donald Trump. Donald Trump won 25 states, and Biden won 25 states plus the District of Columbia. We could not be any more divided. What do we need to do? This could take the whole show, this one question. But what do we need to do to start bringing America back together?
I think the word do is operative there. You know, it's not just a matter of doing. It's a matter of how we think and how we think about our democracy and how we think about each other. You know, Einstein said we will not solve the problems of the world from the level of thinking we were at when we created them. I think one of the things COVID has done, COVID's like some big mother in the sky who has said to all of us, you need to just go to your room and think about what you've done.
Yeah.
Time out.
I think all of us need to really think more deeply and more soberly about so much that we have taken for granted. Our democracy is under assault right now. And the forces that are assaulting it are not liberal or conservative. They are anti-democratic. They are neo-fascist. They are anarchist, although they say other people are anarchists. They are lawless, although they say other people are lawless. And I think there's a kind of golden mean of American politics on both the left and the right, where we need to think of ourselves now as just Americans who need to stand up for our democracy, not just for the things we believe in as conservatives or the things we believe in as progressives or liberals. We need to think about our democracy itself. All of us lay down some of the swords in our heads, recognize where our democracy needs us now. And I think that changes you inside to have that reflective and that sober a look at things. You know, I heard somebody say something so interesting yesterday. She said, the way you fight for your democracy is by learning how to stop fighting. And in order to stop to fight for our democracy right now, we have to find that place within us where what we're all in love with is the same thing. And that's the basic tenets of American democracy. And when we get a critical mass of that, then answers will emerge, solutions will unfold, and trajectories of possibility will lie before us that otherwise we will not be able to find.
But, you know, we seem so entrenched. I absolutely agree with you. I remember growing up in an America where being an American meant something, you know,
exactly.
Not a Democrat or a Republican, but being American, you know, we all had that sense of pride and that feeling. And it seems to me that's gone. But in a country that's so divided and we're so entrenched, how do we get people, you know, I'm seeing things on the internet I can't believe that people are saying, the fake news that people are latching onto. What do we do to change that mindset? Isn't there something that we need to do, that being the operative word again, to get people to move in that direction?
And may I suggest, before you answer that one of your quotes that I found exceedingly poignant was that this is the time and we are the people. And I think that kind of speaks to the question that the senator is asking, would you suggest, Ms. Williamson?
Absolutely. I think that when we realize, and I think most people do realize on some level, the depth of the problem that we have right now, we realize we are a generation as challenged as any generation before us. I mean, this is serious, serious stuff. I mean, we had a civil war in this country. We're in a cold civil war right now. But I think that other generations have risen to the occasion.
Yeah, I think you're right.
We need to identify with the problem solvers in our past. And we need to think hard right now about what it meant to be an abolitionist, what it meant to be a woman suffragette, what it meant to be a civil rights worker. And to me, that's the meaning of we are the ones and this is the time. We didn't expect this in our lifetime. We thought that the generation that fought World War II had kind of taken care of the last great challenge that America would have to be dealing with generationally. And this came upon us. It's like when Franklin Roosevelt said, we have a rendezvous with destiny. Apparently, we did too. We didn't expect us. Not that they expected Pearl Harbor. But this really is so far beyond what any of us thought was possible. No one thought, even those of us who were the most unhappy when Donald Trump was elected, none of us thought he could do this much damage in 3 years. None of us thought he could harness this much hatred, bigotry, racism, homophobia, anti-Semitism, xenophobia. What you were just saying, Michael, about some of the stuff you see on social media. I mean, there is eliminationist talk out there. I mean, there's some talk on right-wing radio these days that's not that different from Radio Rwanda. Right. I mean, it's terrible when you have Steve Bannon. Not only that you have someone like Steve Bannon talking about beheading people, but then you have Mark Zuckerberg saying that that's not really a reason to take him off Facebook.
Yeah.
I mean, this thing is so out of control. And I think everybody needs to go into our own hearts and ask ourselves what's important, because American democracy is shattering in front of our eyes right now. And I think that the answer really is going to come from another level of it, another level that we reach within our own hearts and minds, and something emerges. From conscience and from love and from compassion, because the mortal mind, this is bigger than the mortal mind alone can handle.
So yeah, I would suggest that the fact that Newsweek has tapped you to be a contributor speaks to the fact that we are thinking differently. Because would you see yourself doing op-eds such as you did, and you wrote a brilliant one right after the election on November 8th, and you were succinct, and you were blunt, and you were straightforward, And you said things like Joe Biden's win is not a healing, it's a reprieve. And you went into great detail about what needs to be done, which I'm happy to say at some point during the broadcast, which I also thought was brilliant. But Ms. Williamson, you have been, I would suggest that this is a career pivot for you. And I think it speaks to the depth about what we recognize and realize we are in troubled times and we need to do something differently. And I believe you're one of those voices.
Well, thank you. This is actually, oh, I think I better, are you receiving a, are you getting a feedback? Am I okay? Okay.
No.
Is not really a career pivot for me in that I majored in writing and speaking about universal spiritual principle, but I minored in political activism always. So it wasn't like I woke up one morning and was interested in these things. I just started talking about these things on a more public stage. This is how I see it. We have 50 million people in America, as you and I speak, who are hungry. We have 30 million people in America who are facing eviction. We have cars lined up for miles and miles with people who are willing to wait for hours in the hopes of getting a $30 food coupon. And I think it's also very relevant in a country that has just completely let go any mature embrace of long-term thinking, that there are children in those cars. And those children are going to be angry and traumatized adults 10 years, 15, and 20 years from now. We have no idea the catastrophe we are allowing to breed right now. So I believe when you ask what do we need to do, I know what I believe we need to do. I think Joe Biden needs to come in with nothing short of an FDR-like plan to infuse the life of the average American with major economic rescue. And he can do a lot of that with executive order. There should be at least the equivalent of Medicare for all. He can cancel those college loans. He can provide a lot towards free college tuition. Now, on one hand, you might say, well, she's a progressive. But let's get rid of these labels for a moment and think of it not in terms of left and right, but in terms of human suffering, in terms of the chronic economic tension and anxiety that now is being experienced, was already experienced by tens of millions of people even before the pandemic. Because even before the pandemic, you had 40% of Americans who could not afford a $400 unexpected expenditure. And that was even before. And now you have a Congress. You have Mitch McConnell adjourning the Senate and saying, we're going home. We're going home. What do you mean you're going home? So when you say, what do we need to do? I believe, of course, we all have our different opinions about this. I believe Joe Biden has to come in so strong from day one to see this as nothing short of Great Depression era social and economic conditions, because it is nothing short of that. For tens of millions of Americans, and with nothing less profound and helpful than FDR's New Deal.
Well, let me just add to what Maria said. In reading that article you did for Newsweek, which is a great article, you said that Biden will bring back the old crowd. He'll bring back the people from the former Obama administration and Democratic establishment people. Since Maria and I have decided in our infinite political wisdom that you are the answer to the problem, how do we get you to fit in? Does there have to be a new party? Can the Democrats hook up with you somehow? And can you help heal America? Or does there need to be a whole movement that's outside both political parties?
The Democrat Party include progressives?
Yeah.
Well, that's the same question, really. One person, obviously, is our salvation. There has to be a revolution of thought and consciousness among all of us. the fact that so many Americans chronically disengaged from the political process over the last two decades is part of the problem. The fact that we thought, well, we elected him, and so we're cool. And I think many people did that with Obama. We thought, well, we got Obama elected, we can take our eye off the ball. And I think, as it turns out, many people see that Obama's presidency was the neoliberal path that led us to a point where there was so much economic pain and suffering and rage out there as to create a petri dish of vulnerability for the likes of a Donald Trump. We all know what happened in the presidential race. I was certainly there. I was in the belly of the beast. The way the political media industrial complex works is that there is a pre-prescribed conversation and a pre-prescribed set of people that they deem and what they seem to feel is their infinite wisdom. And they don't believe that anyone else should be considered qualified to be part of the conversation. Now, this is particularly ironic to me because the qualification that they believe in is that you've spent decades living within the system that drove us into this ditch. So if you've had a lot of experience driving the car that drove us into this ditch, according to them, then you should be considered qualified, and only you should be considered qualified to drive us out of the ditch. And I experienced firsthand, really, the viciousness with which they will exclude someone from the conversation. Smears, personal attacks, politics of personal destruction, et cetera. Now, during the campaign, clearly progressives were sidelined. And progressives were told, just be quiet and wait till he's won. Unfortunately, as you both are clearly aware, now that he's won, we're still being told, wait. Now we're being told, wait till the dust settles. But that's ridiculous, because wait till the dust settles means wait until we've already appointed all the people we want to appoint, which if we do wait till the dust settles, will certainly be more in the corporatist direction. And then I guess the promise is we'll hear you out, but it won't make any difference because the appointments have already been made and the trajectory has been set. Now, I think the real battle going on now then is for the soul of the Democratic Party. Now, there is a group of people led by Nick Branagh, for whom I have great respect, who are starting the People's Party. We all know the dangers there. We know the danger of the Jill Stein factor. We know the 87,000 votes she got, which if she had not gotten, would mean that Trump would not have become president. But I think also many people, myself included, are also asking, how long are we supposed to wait? How long is this huge demographic and Bernie Sanders' success in 2016 and in 2020 proved that this is a huge factor? How long are people to be expected to wait patiently for what, their turn? Is Big Pharma waiting its turn? Is Big Oil waiting its turn? Are military industrial contractors waiting their turn? Are health insurance companies waiting their turn? Are corporate lobbyists waiting their turn? I heard a woman on NPR saying the left needs to be patient and just take what they can. Well, that, I'm sorry, that kind of codependent, even abusive relationship between progressives and the establishment Democrats, it's something's going to crack. It's not going to work this time. So I know I'm someone who, because I do have I'm old enough to have an institutional memory of a time when the Democrats indisputably stood for the working people of the United States. I'm in my own heart and mind holding on to see what happens. Really, I think the answer to this question will be obvious within the next 2 months. And I think that if Biden does not go in direction of major economic rescue policies, something akin to Medicare for All, cancellation of college loan debt, free college tuition, Green New Deal, et cetera, then I think we're in very, very serious danger of a Trump-like figure people winning, possibly even winning the House back in 2022, the Senate, and God help us, winning the White House in 2024.
And we have a couple callers with questions.
Yeah, we do.
We have got Michael on line 4 from Kansas. Welcome to BBS Radio and Shadow Politics.
Okay. Am I live or am I still on mute?
Yes, you're live.
Okay, Marianne, this is your Michael. How you doing?
Hello.
I'm fine, thank you.
Now, I just as a point of disclosure, Marianne probably does not remember me from a hole in the ground, but she often says incorrectly that somebody helped her. It's true, she helped a lot of people, but I'm one of those people that in my 20s, she helped me. And so I just want to just throw that out there. The topic is really a specific date. We have this big date coming up, which is December 14th. So it's not so much a question as we hear all of this backroom rumbling about the possibility of what could happen if we have faithless electors on December 14th. So I'm not sure if you want me to be part of this or just put that out there, but Marianne, all my love to you, sweetheart, and I look forward to helping in every way I can. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Michael, for the call.
Thanks for sharing, Michael. Let me just say that in response to what you said, Michael, we already see America standing up. You know, we have the Republican Secretary of State in Georgia certifying the election results.
After the hand count.
We have Donald Trump's own appointed head of voter security from Homeland Security, who unfortunately was fired, saying this is the most secure election in American history. Yes. So, right. So we believe that all the electors will stand up and do what they're appointed to do, or at least enough of them to make Joe Biden the next president. So I wouldn't particularly worry about that.
May I say something just for the fun of it?
Yeah, please. Please.
Okay. So, I think all three of you will get a chuckle out of this. You know, Joe Biden did not steal my vote as a Republican. Yes, I am a Republican and running as a Republican.
We like Republicans.
But Joe Biden did not steal my vote. Donald Trump lost my vote because of how he handled the pandemic. I could go on and on and on, but I'm going to leave it at that. It's just he lost my vote. So this whole notion of the faithless electors potentially doing something on December 14th is kind of strange to me, because I wonder if there are 7 to 10 million people just like me, registered as Republicans, who at some point said, you know, I think I'm going to go with my friends Sidney Payne or Marianne Williamson. Yes.
Yes, that would be me, Michael.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's the first time I voted for a Democrat for president in my entire life.
Thank you for calling in.
And thank you. And we've got Susie on line 5 from Long Island. Susan, welcome to Shadow Politics and BBS Radio.
Hi, guys. Hi, Marianne. Hi. I'm a big fan. I've met you a couple of times at Marble Collegiate and a couple of times on your campaign trail in Brooklyn and Long Island.
Nice.
So question is, do you think it'll take a great master like Gandhi, MLK Jr., to get us out of this ditch? And do you think you're that great master?
No. This is not an age. The zeitgeist today is not about a revolution led by soloists. You know, when you have a revolution led by soloists, they know how to handle it. All they have to do is shoot the soloist. This is a song this time. Everybody is singing their note. You know, even Gandhi said the Indian Revolution, he said, the Indian independence movement is led by the small, still voice within. You know, when the story of this era is written, there will be tales of some very, very corrupt people in very high places. But there will also be tales of heroes all over the place. And even in the last call, when Michael was on the line, and he was talking about some of these election officials around the country. Many of them are Republicans. Many of the election officials who have fought back against this ridiculous slow coup that the Trump legal force team is trying to
to perpetrate here are Republicans. And that's what I meant earlier about the golden mean of American politics. I think it's interesting what Maria said. It's interesting what Michael said. These are Republicans. This is not even a Democratic or Republican issue. And that, of course, is what makes this moment so scary. It's not just the ascendance of a man like Donald Trump. That has happened enough throughout history. But the fact that so many people who should know better, and certainly somewhere in their heart do know better, within his own party, have not been willing to stand up to him. But it's very interesting, isn't it, how many people within the field of the election officials around the country have been willing to do that. So, no, it's not about waiting for one person. God knows not me or anyone else. It's about the voice of all of us that is citizens. We have to shift our self-identification from consumer to citizen. That's where we got off track. We went overboard with thinking of ourselves and acting like consumers, and we underestimated the importance of taking the responsibilities of citizenship. And that is something that not only has to be adjusted within our hearts and minds and our behavior, but we must never make that mistake again.
You know, I think that's such an important thing to say, Susie, if I can just add to that. And I think, you know, the point that Marianne is making is very pointed. The people that are the electors and the election officials are, for the most part, volunteers. They're not in it for the power. They're not in it for the glory. They're in it because they want to make a better America, and they feel a responsibility for what they're doing. And I think that's, I believe that's very hopeful. Maria, do you have a question?
Michael, you were talking a couple. Oh, I'm sorry. Did you say Maria? Forgive me.
No, that's okay.
It's fine.
That's fine. Go ahead, Maria.
A couple of minutes ago, you mentioned Mr. Krebs, the one who was fired by the president for saying it was the most secure election. I thought, watching all those people counting those votes, one Republican, one Democrat, I thought it was very touching. Yeah. And like you said, these are volunteers. These are volunteers who were just there to make this country better. And it was so heartbreaking to see where was in Atlanta, where there were crowds with guns outside.
Yeah,
it's outrageous. But I think, once again, as much as we've seen some things that horrify us, I think we also have seen and continue to see a lot of things exhibited by a lot of people that we can be proud of. All of us know that in whatever way possible, it's our time to step up on behalf of our country. Once again, it doesn't even matter at that level whether you're Democrat or Republican. Going back to what Maria said originally, this is the time and we are the people. And I think all of us in our own hearts and our own communities will be shown what that means for us.
I just thought it's so timely that it would be a good opportunity not only to create awareness, but perhaps create more following about what you did just yesterday and the day before about women's wisdom in times of crisis, and what you can tell us about what your agenda was, if you will, or itinerary, and then what those two events were like.
Well, the political and economic system that dominates certainly our society and many advanced democracies were devised before women had a voice in the public sphere. And women were seen as, our job was to take care of the children. And when it came to how politics would operate, when it came to how the economy operated, we were on the sidelines. But we're not on the sidelines anymore. And many of the things that women have traditionally cared about the most in our lives are things that now need to be front and center in terms of how politics and economics work. Namely, first of all, take care of the children before everything else. Are the children fed? Are the children clothed? Are the children educated? And are the children safe? That should be numero uno in any policy agenda that helps us move from an economic to a humanitarian bottom line and from an unsustainable to a sustainable option for the human race and future. The other issue has to do with the fact that we have traditionally cared for the home. Well, the earth is the home we all share. So
So right now, we have to be thinking about the children, not just our own children, but every mother's child. We have to be thinking about the home we share. Now, then you ask yourself, looking at the economic power that women have, looking at the electoral power that we have, looking at the numerical power we have, we already live in a world where there are so many very, very dangerous threats, not just to our good, but literally to our survival, which if American women stood up and said, with our money and with our votes, that stops now, would change. So you ask yourself, why isn't it happening? And what I have seen in my life, and I'm sure, Maria, you have your own story, we don't live in a culture where we are shackled physically. There are some women who still are in this world, but not in America. For the most part, we can say what we want to say, and we can do what we want to do. But not all walls are visible. Misogyny is very insidious, and misogyny is not only demonstrated by men, but it's internalized by a lot of women. So what happens in the United States today is that sometimes it's the woman herself who does not give herself emotional permission to stand forth and say what she really believes and stand for what she really believes in. And I must say, I feel from my run in for president, I saw misogyny at work in ways that did make me go, wow. Some of the smears against me that simply would not have, nobody would have even tried it if it were a man. And I don't think people would have been so easily duped by it if I were a man as well. So I've seen how the system works, and that's why I wanted to do the weekend as an opportunity for all of us as women to look at the ways that we're not yet expanded into the fullness of who we are and can be at this time, to face the fears, to surrender the thoughts and the behavioral patterns that are the blocks to our full empowerment that lie in our own consciousness and our own behavioral patterns, and to rise together. That's what I think we're all trying to do right now. We have to rise to the occasion. And I believe also, as someone who ran, that experience increased my faith in the American people. It increased my faith in American democracy. My experience was that voters themselves are very smart. And that, I have a 35, 37 year career talking with audiences and talking particularly with people up close and personal in times of personal despair and challenge. I've seen how noble people can be, how intelligent people can be. My father was a lawyer. He used to say, talk to the smartest person on the jury. So by running, I felt I got a very up close and personal experience of both how smart, aspirational, and capable the voters are, as well as how corrupt our political and media system can be.
Well, so as a follow-up, though, yeah, Marianne, will you be offering that again, or was it a one-off about women's wisdom?
I think the tape will be available. I think, I'm sure if people go to marianne.com, people can, I'm not sure exactly how that works, but the tape I know will be available for 3 months to the people who attended, and I think at a certain point it will probably be for sale for people who were not. The proceeds actually for that particular seminar are going to pay for my campaign debt that I saw in person.
Well, speaking of campaigns, we had a question sent in from Sharon from Pennsylvania. She notes that you have run for Congress and you have run for president, and she wants to know if you're going to run again. Any plans to run again for something?
I don't know. I ran before because every cell of my being said yes. I once heard Oprah Winfrey say, don't do something unless every part of you says yes.
Well, you did very, very well on with many indicators. You raised over $8 million for your presidential campaign. You came in fourth out of, I don't know how many, 20 candidates when you ran for Congress. And you got the most votes of anybody who was not either a Democrat or Republican. So, you know, you, as we say in the business, Ms. Williamson, you've got legs when it comes to running, and you're certainly a great candidate. So,
Well, thank you so much. Thank you.
And what do you think of the fact that we have now just elect 51 women of color to Congress? Do you think we're making, is that a great stride, or do we need to do so much more in that regard since we're on the subject of women?
Well, I think it is a great stride. When I look at people like AOC, I look at Jamal Bowman, of course, he's a man, not a woman, but I think at a certain point, you know, I'm so tired of some of this conversation about identity politics, but because that's the particular question, Cori Bush, it's extremely important when you see some of these people, Ilhan Omar, Rashid, it's very, very important, some of these women, the diversity that is being represented, most particularly because, not because just of the color of their experience, the color of their skin, but because of the experience that they got in many ways because of the color of their skin. And to hear Yana Presley, to hear AOC, to hear Cori Bush, to hear them go on and on about their outrage, their moral outrage at the audacity of these congressional figures who are willing to go home in the middle of this pandemic and not answer to the profound human suffering that is created by this economic need that people have. The fact that people got that one-time $1,200 stimulus payment, the fact that we paid over $4 trillion in a COVID bailout, but only one-fifth of it went to individuals. And I don't think that Democrats should kid ourselves, because this obviously corporate-centric bailout is the same template as the corporate-centric bailout in 2008, and that was a Democratic president. So, yes, I think it's great that we have more Black women, because they are expressing the moral outrage of the conscience of America. But they're not the only ones. And I think just like not every woman is a feminist, and sometimes the greater equality for women is articulated by men, I think we have to be careful. Somebody's religion, somebody's skin color, somebody's sex, it's important, but we have forgotten that it's the unity, it's the e pluribus unum. It's out of many, one. It can't all be who's Black, who's Latino, who's Jewish, who's Christian, who's Hindu, who's Muslim, who's older, who's younger, who's Black, who's white, who's straight, who's gay. I think you have to have more than the pieces of the mosaic. You have to have the board underneath it. We need to remember the unum here. That's why I think when we were talking earlier about the fact that some of these election officials who are holding the line, they're Republicans. It can't all be about that which separates us. We're always talking about what separates us, and then we're complaining that we're not united. Well, some of our conversation has to be who we are as Americans right now. That has got to be an equal part of this conversation. And once again, unity in diversity. It's got to be the unity as well as the diversity.
So is this the great catalyst? Is coronavirus the great catalyst for us? You talk about people like FDR, and, you know, FDR was certainly the man for his time, right? In the middle of right after the Depression, in the middle of a world war. Is that what we need to bring us together, is a crisis? And do you think this crisis will do it? Will it bring us together?
It's interesting. I heard Lynn Twist say in my seminar the other night, she said that COVID is not just a sickness, COVID is also the medicine. It is forcing us into deeper reflection. We're a very frenetic, distracted culture. We're usually running around like chickens with our head chopped off, and it's almost an excuse to not think deeply about what's actually going on in our lives, much less what's going on in our collective experience. Blaise Pascal, the French philosopher, said that every problem can be traced to man's inability to sit quietly in a room alone. And we're being now in some very uncomfortable, but ultimately I think important ways to sit quietly in a room alone. Now, in terms of leaders who emerge at such times, one of the most fascinating things about FDR has to do with his polio and his trips to Warm Springs, Georgia. I always forget, was it Warm Springs or Hot Springs? It was Warm Springs,
no,
Georgia, right?
Warm Springs, yeah.
Right. And the story, of course, that many Americans might not know, you know, this was a man, he was Franklin Delano Roosevelt. I mean, you couldn't get more aristocratic than that.
Yeah, true.
His uncle, Theodore Roosevelt, had been president. He was governor of New York. He was tall. He was handsome. He had everything. And then one day he went to a political event, which he did not want to go to, by the way. He drank from a water fountain. He took a nap that afternoon and never was able to walk again because he had been struck by polio, right, which obviously was in that water. Now, when he went down to Warm Springs, Georgia, the people there did not know from Franklin Delano Roosevelt. That, you know, this was before social media. This was before any of the kind of electronic communication. They just saw another sufferer, and they helped him. And that is such an important part of his story. If he had not gotten polio, he would not have experienced himself as vulnerable. If he had not experienced polio and gone down to Warm Springs, Georgia, he would not have experienced the kindness and graciousness of strangers who themselves were sufferers, who themselves had so little, who helped him in his time of need. And that definitely, without a doubt, marked him and made him the man of the moment who was incapable of ignoring the suffering of so many people who are experiencing the ravages of the Great Depression. And that's what we hope for Joe Biden. It's what I hope for. And I think my hope is that his age will help us here. Because he's at a point, what the hell? I may as well just follow my heart.
Yeah.
You know what? I'm not
going to
do
this again.
What do I
have to lose?
Exactly. Yeah. And I'm hoping. That's my prayer. I know he's a religious Catholic. He himself has been touched by so much suffering, the death of so many of his own immediate family members. And that's my prayer for him. And I, you know, listen, he's far more moderate than I. He's far more, you know, the neoliberal than I. He's more the establishment politician. And I have some real problems with the way all that went down. But we are where we are. And I pray that, and like I said, I have no doubt that I'm sure he's praying as well. And I hope that angels will surround him at this time. He has a profound challenge. Every president has a profound challenge, but this is one of those moments, like you said. This is a moment, this is one of those moments of destiny, what he's got in front of him. And I hope that he will be touched as FDR was touched, and that he will become a great leader, because we need one now.
Yeah, me too. I keep on thinking what my grandmother used to say, be careful what you wish for, when I think about what he's about to go into. Maria,
that's right.
Do you have a question?
I do. Marianne, the senator mentioned at the beginning of the program about your founding the Project Angel Food, which thank you for that, and the 13 million meals. But you also co-founded the Peace Alliance. Would you share with our listeners what that was about? You founded it in March of 2004, so you've got quite a history and lots of regional and national conferences. I'd like our listeners to know more about that.
Thank you. I first heard former Congressman Dennis Kucinich talk about the Department of Peace legislation that he bring to national attention, and which he did bring to national attention when he was in the House of Representatives. It has never gotten as far as we needed to get, but the idea of a Department of Peace was a basic pillar of my own campaign. We have a $760 billion, some would say it's more, Pentagon budget. And we have a $40 billion State Department budget. Now, when you look at how we look at healing the physical body, we have transitioned. Mainstream consciousness has left behind a paradigm around health where you don't think you have to take care of your diet. You don't think you have to exercise. You don't think you have to watch your lifestyle. You just figure you don't have to take care of your body. And then if you get sick, you just hope that some doctor can provide through external remedy
will be able to suppress or eradicate the symptoms. We don't think of health and sickness that way anymore. We know you have to proactively create health. You have to try to prevent sickness. We know that sickness is the absence of health. Health is not the absence of sickness. We have to start looking at civilization the same way. War is the absence of peace. Peace is not the absence of war. But we have a situation, and everybody knows this, we have a war economy. 53 cents of every dollar is spent on defense-related activities. There are billions of dollars to be made in defense contracting. Now, with that $760 billion, this is hundreds of billions of dollars more than our military leaders say they need. So do I think there should be a strong military? I think we all do. None of us are naive about the dangers in the world. However, hundreds of billions of that budget doesn't have anything to do with genuine military needs. It has to do with short-term profit maximization for military-industrial complex and its undue influence on our Congress. Now, all that's fine unless you want to try to behave responsibly towards the future and the probability of our own grandchildren being able to live on this planet. Now, there is a way to wage peace. Just like you can prevent sickness, you can prevent war. You can prevent the probability of war, to be sure. And there are four basic factors of peace creation, peace building. We need to wage peace as proactively as we know we must learn, know how to wage peace, wage war should war be necessary. Those four factors are, number one, expanded economic opportunities for women, expanded educational opportunities for children, a reduction of violence against women, and the amelioration of unnecessary human suffering. When those four factors are present, statistically, you have a higher incidence of peace, and you have a lower incidence of violence. And we should see large groups of desperate people as a national security risk, whether in a corner of an American city or another corner of the world. As a matter of fact, when we were talking before about the 8 years before Trump was elected, when Hillary came along saying, let's just continue the success of the Obama years, millions of people said, what success? I'm drowning here. And their rage was legitimate. They felt their pain was unseen and unnamed. Only two candidates named their pain and validated their rage. It was Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. And that's what I meant earlier in our conversation when I said we should be thinking about those millions of children hungry right now, watching their parents go through the despair and the pain that they're going through right now in the absence of COVID relief, because those kids are going to be grown-ups in 10 years, in 15 years, and they're going to be pissed. And you think we have a problem on our hands now, God help us then.
There's nothing more dangerous than somebody that has nothing to lose. I agree with you 100%. And right after this election in 2016, I spoke to a group of women, and one of them stood up and said, as Democrats, we have nothing to apologize for. And my response to that was, of course we have something to apologize for. This man would not be president if we had done our job. So I agree with you 100%.
Tell people, Michael, I'm sorry. Well,
no, go ahead.
As a candidate, you not only are you correct, but there is such, and I think this is starting to break now. I think there's a little crack in the armor right now. But there has been, just as you said, that what that woman said is so indicative of this impulse in the Democratic Party, this absolute refusal to look in the mirror, absolute refusal to really deeply register how much damage neoliberalism has done to the way people perceive the Democratic Party. And until the Democratic Party is willing to take a good look in the mirror, then too many millions of people that we can electorally handle will say pox on both your houses at the very best if they don't just vote Republican.
I agree. We're often, you know, as a neoliberal myself, you know, I see that people around me, in the Democratic Party are always talking down to America. They want to tell you how to think. They want to tell you, you know, what's best. And they're not listening. They're only talking. They're not listening. So I agree with you. And when it comes
there's
to listening.
There's a smugness and an arrogance.
Oh, my God. So much so. But while we're talking about listening, tell people how they can hear your podcast. We know you have a podcast.
Thank you.
How do you tune
thank
in?
You. Thank you so much. Where well, wherever people go, Spotify, iTunes, YouTube, wherever people go to hear their podcast, it's called the Marianne Williamson Podcast. You know, Michael Lewis right now, the one that's up now, is Nina Turner, my conversation with the inimitable Nina Turner. And the one that will be posted on Wednesday is Michael Lewis, who wrote that incredible book called The Fifth Risk. And that conversation is really interesting because it's about what happens when a presidential transition is bungled. because it's really interesting how Trump didn't really want to hear anything that the Obama administration wanted to tell them. And now, of course, the Biden administration wants to hear and Trump won't give him the information. It's an exceedingly important thing. There's a quote from that book from a man named Max Steyer who said, a bungled transition leads to a bungled presidency. So the conversation with Michael Lewis about the fifth risk is really, really interesting.
We encourage people to tune in. And let me ask you before we let you leave, because we're running out of time, I think that Marie and I are both very proud of the fact that we had William Darity from Duke University on, who's a leading expert on reparations. And we talked about reparations a long time ago, and we know it was part of your platform. What do you think we can do to address that? And will this heal some of the rancor that's gone on over the systematic racism that's in our system?
Germany has paid $89 billion in reparations to Jewish organizations since World War II. And while obviously it doesn't mean the Holocaust didn't happen, it has gone far towards establishing economic and not just economic, but emotional and psychological reconciliation between Germany and the Jews of Europe. That war was over in 1945. We are still carrying a toxic baton handing down generation to generation ever since the Civil War. I think what I learned on my campaign and what I've seen even before, because I've been writing about this topic since the late 90s, the American people, I don't think the average American is a racist. But I think the average American is woefully undereducated about the history of race in the United States. And what I found in my experience is if you just talk to people and give them a 5-minute 101A history lesson that the first slave ships were brought over in 1619, that the institution of slavery lasted almost 2.5 centuries, that there were between 4 and 5 million formerly enslaved people at the end of the war, Civil War, that they promised, the North promised to every formerly enslaved family of 4, 40 acres and the mule, which would have given them an opportunity to start over. The fact that most of that was not given, that which was given was taken back. The fact that except for 12 years of Reconstruction, the Civil War was followed by another 100 years of domestic terrorism against black people in the South. The fact that that was not ended until 1965. With the Civil Rights Act to dismantle segregation. And that was 64. Then in 65, the Voting Rights Act. And so once again, I don't want to diminish the struggles or the sacrifices of any of our ancestors, black or white, but there's a huge piece that has still not been addressed. And in some ways, we all know we've actually gone backwards. Mass incarceration means we're going backwards. Disparity in criminal sentencing between blacks and whites means we're sliding backwards. The piece of economic restitution is still a gaping wound. It not only makes a tremendous difference economically, it's been established that if black families manifest as much wealth as white families, our economy would be $1.5 trillion larger. But it's also the psychological and the emotional and even moral wound that lies in the fact that one people historically did tremendous damage to another people. And just as Germany and other nations have learned, reparations are important because there's an inherent mea culpa. It is an acknowledgement of a wound, of a wrong that was done, of a debt that was owed, and the willingness on the part of a people to pay it. So, yes, I think reparations would make a tremendous difference, and I do believe it's an idea whose time has come.
And to your point, there is something called post-traumatic slave syndrome, which is a condition that exists when a population has experienced multi-generational trauma.
Absolutely.
And that's from centuries of slavery, and continue to experience oppression and institutionalized racism today. And
absolutely.
Deaths by police. And I mean, it goes on and on and on. So, yeah, it's not some trifling nuisance that we need to just brush away.
Well, and unfortunately, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, we're seeing not only a recognition of things that happened in the past, but things that are happening in the present. These two young kids who were killed in Jacksonville by the police yesterday. These 16 and 17-year-old black kids.
Horrible.
And the police say, well, there's a suspicion they were trying to steal a car. What are we living in? What country are we living in? So the topic is up, and God help us if we don't rise to the occasion of doing the right thing and trying to be a generation that makes a real difference. This must be dealt with, and I believe we have it in us to do that.
Well, we're out of time, but that's a great place to end. And Marianne Williamson, thank you so much for being on our show. I think that you add so much to the conversation. I know you'll stay involved, and we certainly will keep an eye on you. And I hope that in the future, sometime as we progress and we see what President-elect Biden does, and we pray for his for him the same way you do, we hope you'll come back and talk to us again. Thank you so much.
It was an honor to be with both of you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Continued success. And we thank our listeners, as always, for making us part of your lives as well.
Thank you, Maria. And we always leave with a song dedicated to our guests. So here's a classic from Elvis Costello. We'll see you next week. Thank you.
Give the people their right to vote.